just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pinpair, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize, and a professor at Columbia University School of Social Work. His forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pinpair.
Thank you, Ian. Pleasure to be here.
And the Census Bureau have just announced their 2012 findings on poverty, and they also talk about health insurance coverage and generally give us a picture, which, by the way, there was a recent study, or actually it's not come out yet, that indicated 4 out of 5 Americans experience joblessness and the threat of homelessness at least once in their lives. That report's yet to come out, but it really questioned the very nature of, or the notion that we are a middle-class country, as always, you notice President Obama always appeals to the middle class. And it may well be that we're much more of a working-class country than a middle-class country. So let's start with, in that framework, where would you put the poor?
Well, I mean, I think it's useful that you bring up what we discover if we step back and we look at poverty over time. The numbers that came out today show that at the moment that the survey the Census Bureau conducts was conducted, we have about 15% of the American population officially in poverty. That's the equivalent of about $23,000 a year for a family of four. But what that tells us is how many people are poor during the course of that survey. But one of the things that we know from other research, as you mentioned, is that large numbers, in fact, of Americans move in and out of poverty over time. So if we, say, step back and look at a 3-year period, look at using Census Bureau data again from 2009 to 2011, if we ask how many people were poor for at least 2 months or more at any point over that 3-year period, that's not 15%. That's closer to 32%. We're approaching a third of Americans over any given 3-year period of time will find themselves poor at least once. And I think this is important in part because we I think, tend to think of poverty as long-term, persistent poverty that people face for years and years and years. That's important, and we should pay attention to that. But that's a very small portion of people who are poor in the United States. Maybe 3.5% over that 3-year period were poor for the entire 3-year period. So in some ways, the message here is one about persistent insecurity, not poverty, and that people who are working class 1 year may find themselves poor the next. People who are middle class may find themselves moving, particularly in periods of economic downturn, from middle class to working class to poor to very poor. And then if all goes well, may climb that back up again. But it really is, I think, useful that we step aside from these sort of point-in-time measures because that doesn't accurately give us a sense of the dynamism of moving in and out of poverty in the U.S.
But what this U.S. Census Bureau report on poverty does tell us is that 21.8% of our nation's children live in poverty, and that 57,000 low-income children have just lost their Head Start services due to sequestration. Is it true, and it seems to be the case, that of all the advanced industrial countries, the United States is the only country that is not trying to deal with poverty and reduce it and eliminate it, but in fact is creating policies that are exacerbating and increasing poverty? In other words, that we are not trying to reduce poverty. Our policies, particularly in the Republican House, are increasing poverty.
It has been, as an empirical matter, true that the United States has higher levels of poverty overall, of child poverty in particular, than any other rich democracy on the planet. And that there has been some progress. If we go back to the early 1950s and look at child poverty rates, it was probably a bit higher then than it is now. But we still live in a world in which between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 American children can count on being in a poor household. It's much worse for African-American children. It winds up being closer to half. And again, if we look at that movement over time, we've got more than half, maybe two-thirds of all American children will at some point be in a poor household. And you're absolutely right. If we look at policies over the course of the last year and a half or so, particularly related to the sequester, a lot of your listeners may not quite get the sense of what the effects of the sequester have been, in part because they have been so concentrated among poor and low-income populations. We've seen rather large cuts in Head Start, which is not just about education, mind. Keep in mind that a lot of low-income families use Head Start as daycare, so that winds up having a really profound impact on low-income families' ability to work and what it costs them then to provide for childcare. So you wind up driving the very families that many people would tell you they want to help, those that are working and trying very hard to support themselves, you wind up creating these awful kinds of feedback effects where you drive them deeper into poverty. Of course, at the same time in which we're slated to have a vote in the House of Representatives on a budget this week that would cut somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 billion to $80 billion out of the food stamp program over the course of the next 10 years, the benefits of which disproportionately accrue to children and to working families. So again, we've got this real disconnect between the supposed aims of a lot of the rhetoric, as you say, particularly among the majority in the House of Representatives, and the actual impact that the policies they're proposing would have. And it really is, I think, perhaps the shocking bit is that while we are looking at making things a bit worse among the poorest families, there's nothing new about this. I mean, we've had poverty rates at this level, child poverty rates at this level since the 1980s. And while we've seen fluctuation up and down over time, the reality is that every other rich democracy on the planet has figured out a way to have significantly lower poverty rates and significantly lower child poverty rates than we do, and yet we fail again and again.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pimpare, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He's a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work, and his forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. Now, one of the House Republicans who is pushing for this big cut in food stamps, the so-called SNAP program, which feeds the poor families and particularly children, he is also the biggest recipient of farm aid, which is right-wing welfare in the state of Tennessee. And so is this indicative of, as you've pointed out, that poverty is not a policy problem, it's a political problem? And is this to say that because our politics have been captured by the wealthy, that America is taking care of the wealthy, these wealthy farmers, this wealthy farmer in Tennessee who gets enormous crop subsidies from the federal government, he's the one who's trying to literally impoverish and starve children in this country? It's mind-boggling.
Well, we don't even have to necessarily go so far as to wonder whether if the intent here isn't to do physical harm, but I think we can do what I don't think we do often enough, which is to think about the who is it who benefits from high unemployment rates, from high poverty rates, from weakened access to food stamps, to weakened access to disability programs. And if we look around the world, one of the things that we notice is that those nations with much more elaborate welfare states have higher wages. And part of that is because if you live in a world in which there are good social supports available to you, if there are good unemployment insurance programs, good access to health care, good access to cash assistance programs, good access to housing subsidies, what that means is that if you find yourself unemployed, you've got a little bit of money that makes it possible for you to survive so that you can turn down genuinely dreadful job offers that offer you low wages and lack of upward mobility and don't provide security. If you live in a world in which you can't get food stamps and you can't get unemployment insurance and the minimum wage has been stagnant since the late 1960s, that very much works to the benefit of employers. If you have a desperate, scared workforce, they will take whatever job is available at whatever wage you offer to them because there's no better option available. Right? This is something the U.S. Chamber of Commerce knew during welfare reform debates in the 1960s. There was a member of the United States Chamber present at every congressional hearing around welfare reform. What on earth does the United States Chamber of Commerce care about welfare reform? Because one of the consequences of welfare reform in 1996 was somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million additional low-skill, less-educated workers being pushed out into the labor market, which, given what we know about basic principles of supply and demand, tends up driving down wages. So I don't think we necessarily have to think of House members as being sociopaths, but that we can think of as engaging in a rational effort to pursue the interest of their electoral benefactors.
So then, given that these new cuts that are being proposed in the House, on top of cuts of 18.6% in the Department of Labor, Health and Human Services and Education, this $45 billion, could be up to $80 billion in the food stamps. They're also cutting funds for meals for homebound seniors, vocational training programs for those who've lost their jobs, and food, as we've said, under the SNAP program. And they're also going after disability insurance. And frankly, there may well be some fraud and abuse in that arena, but there's no fraud and abuse in food stamps, or if there is, it's negligible.
And for that matter, none. That there was a recent GAO, General Accountability Office, a government monitoring agency report on the SSDI, the disability program, and they were actually unable to identify any documented fraud. What they did find was that the Bureau wasn't sufficiently staffed to keep up with the paperwork that was coming in, so there may have been some instances of benefits being granted that shouldn't have, but that wasn't people trying to dishonestly get benefits. It's the bureaucracy not being well funded enough to monitor the program. But no evidence of fraud and abuse in food stamps or in disability programs. In fact, they have some of the lowest levels of improper payments of any programs that the United States government runs.
Well, Stephen Pinpair, one of the surreal things about the way our government is, in the sense that it's captured, it's by and for the 1%. Is the Department of Agriculture, who also have jurisdiction over food stamps, they also have jurisdiction over the commodities and trading futures market. And as you know, through the Goldman Sachs Index, so much money on Wall Street is gaming the price of gasoline, which is way up now because of a fear over a war with Syria. But you might have noticed it hasn't come down now that that fear of war has gone away, or at least been reduced. And they also game the price of food. So you have this surreal situation where Wall Street is making billions out of making food more expensive and gasoline more expensive, two basic things that working Americans need and have to pay for, at the same time that the Department of Agriculture is turning a blind eye to this activity on Wall Street. They're going after poor people. I mean, I guess it's a loaded question here, but it seems to me that the people who control or direct our government are the ones who are making money, and that all of the people we talk about who are going to be losing meals, the homebound seniors, the vocational training programs, and the poor people who need food for their kids, they simply don't have a political constituency.
We've got now, there are a couple of scholars who have done some sort of fairly elaborate, sophisticated studies on trying to get at this question of who is Congress, in fact, responsive to. One guy called Larry Bartels and another called Martin Dillons, one at University of Virginia and the other at Princeton, I believe. And they both wind up coming to essentially the same conclusion, which is that not only is the American federal government looking at the last 15 to 20 years in particular, unresponsive to the needs of poor and low-income people, but in fact increasingly unresponsive to the needs of middle-class Americans as well. And these are sort of fairly elaborate, sophisticated studies that really do look for expressed needs and desires across the population and try to gauge how likely is it that Congress will respond depending upon who it is that pleads their case. And that, you know, the sort of the rhetoric that people have used for a long time now about the American political system being captured really is a verifiable empirical reality. And in fact, we can see that the larger the percentage of wealthy Americans who support a particular kind of policy, the increased likelihood that that policy will be enacted by Congress. It's not a guarantee because it's a complicated system and there are lots of pieces at work there. But all else equal, the more rich people are in support of a particular policy, the more likely it is to be enacted by the national government. What we find by contrast when we look at the expressed desires of low-income, poor, and middle-income people is that there is absolutely no correlation whatsoever between the number of people in those population groups who support a particular policy and the likelihood that that's going to be enacted. And that, to me, indicates that the poverty problem is a problem that reflects a much larger problem of democracy. And I think that it is curious happenstance that today is not only the release of the new poverty data, but the Constitution Day, the anniversary of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, and the second anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. But I think they all tend to be pointing toward this fundamental problem in the dysfunction of the American political system. And some of this is because we've got an unusually complicated system, right? People will remember this from their cigarettes, the divided institutions, checks and balances, federalism. But in some ways, we created a political system that is on a regular basis at war with itself, particularly if different parties control different pieces. But it makes it extraordinarily difficult to get anything done and creates spaces for particularly well-placed, well-funded interest groups to have influence in that lawmaking process in a way that is simply not the case in other kinds of parliamentary political systems. So this really is the shape of our political institutions that opens up opportunities for rent-seeking interest groups, for people out for their own particular kinds of interests. This has gotten worse over time and has been exacerbated of late because there's so much money in the campaign system itself, right? We live in a world in which 46 million people are getting by on less than the equivalent of $23,000 a year for a family of four. Meanwhile, yesterday or the day before, Forbes released its 400 wealthiest Americans list that showed that there are 400 Americans worth collectively a total of $2 trillion. That's I think, more than the GDP of Russia. And that the average net worth of just those 400 individuals is $5 billion. That's not the economy at work. Those are political decisions. That's changes in tax policy. That's changes in regulation. Those are a movement away from the much more broad-based sort of tax system we had in the immediate post-war period from, say, the 40s to the 70s. But since the 70s, on steroids since the Reagan administration, we've consistently withdrawn taxation on wealthiest individuals and corporations as well as withdrawing regulation while we've allowed the value of social welfare benefits to erode, while we've allowed the minimum wage to erode, while we have in fact created the conditions not just for this inequality but for stagnant well-being across the majority of the population. Right? That's increasingly, I think, a problem of healthy functioning democracy, that it can so poorly respond to the needs of so many for the benefit of the few.
So just in closing, Stephen Pimpare, just in the last minute here, given that there are 46 million Americans living in poverty, that's 15% of the population that's impoverished, what data is there to indicate whether or not these people vote?
Well, we've got all sorts of surveys going on over time, and it's a good question because all else equal, the population who is least likely to vote are low-income, less educated Americans. And that's absolutely a piece of the puzzle, right? If you're a member of the House or the Senate, you need two things in order to maintain office, right? You need campaign contributions in order to run your next election, and you need votes. if, in fact, low-income people can't be counted on for campaign contributions for the obvious reasons and are less likely to vote, there is an extent to which it's entirely rational that their needs be ignored. They can be.
Well, Stephen Pimpare, I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pimpare, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He's a professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work, and his forthcoming book is The Celluloid Poorhouse, 110 Years of Poverty and Homelessness in the Movies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.